You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko jōgai toku ingoa, nō mai haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Thursday the 2nd of March. It's Jōgai here, your host. It's my first time hosting. I'm no Pearl Little, but I will try to create a good show for you. Coming up on the show today, our news director Shemina Smith speaks to the president of AUSA, Will Matthews, regarding a controversial new group that emerged at Auckland University's O Week this week. My producer Jess has a story about Oxfam's Taps Off Day, a new project encouraging Kiwis to go a whole day without turning on their taps in an effort to provide easy access of clean water in the Pacific. We also have Andrew Little back for our weekly chat. BFM reporter Joel Thomas has a report on TVNZ, whether it's a necessary entity in this age of media and whether reform is needed. My producer Jess also has a story on subsidised vaping products. And lastly, we have Lucy Z and Maha Al-Badravi in studio to talk about their new TVNZ miniseries, So This Happened. If you have any thoughts throughout the show, please get in contact by calling 309 3879 or text in on 5395.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
Controversial new group called the Auckland University European Students Association has raised a number of red flags since its recent emergence. Although the group says they are open to all university students that have an interest in European cultures, some are accusing them of promoting white supremacy. Their Facebook page features an image of Captain Cook as well as Celtic and Germanic designs, all of which are being interpreted by some as being similar to iconography used by extremist right-wing groups. At this stage, the university has chosen to permit the group to have a presence at the University of Auckland orientation next week, but the AUSA say this decision is disappointing. News director Shemina spoke to AUSA President Will Matthews and started by asking him about when they first heard about the group.
When did you first hear about the Auckland University European Students Association?
We were alerted to their presence by students the night before last. Students were concerned about iconography and rhetoric on the group that is typical of kind of highly nationalist white pride organisations. Mm. I met with the university yesterday to communicate these concerns. The decision was made to continue to allow the group to have a presence or orientation.
Mm. And is the AUSA alarmed by this?
Yeah, really alarmed and concerned. This group isn't affiliated to AUSA, and that's an important message we want to get out. They have usually only affiliated groups can have stalls at O Week, but the university has had a standard practice of allowing groups that popped up over the summer when AUSA's affiliation process wasn't active to have a stall. They will be applying to affiliate to AUSA in a few weeks, and then the student body can have their say on whether or not they want them to be a part of the community.
Mm. And so what sort of communications have you had with the University of Auckland about this?
So we've met with senior club's administration staff and the university proctor. I did that personally yesterday just to communicate our concerns about the kind of rhetoric and images the club is using.
Mm. And you've communicated that you're concerned that you want more action from the university about it?
It would be our preference if this group does have these views and opinions that those are not represented at Auckland University. I think this campus would become a place where people didn't feel safe if this kind of culture was active.
Mm. And so what are the next steps from here, you see?
Well, obviously the next step is the group's opportunity to affiliate the week after next. We encourage all students to come and engage in a constructive dialogue with the group and for the group themselves to constructively convey their views and purposes to the student body.
Right, so you haven't ruled it out yet that there may sort of be scope for them to be affiliated if they can kind of prove that they don't actually have any of these sort of extremist ideologies?
That's a decision for the student body to make. ASA just facilitates the process.
Rewire.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
That was Shimena speaking to AUSA President Will Matthews on the European Students Association that emerged this week. Next up, New Zealanders around the country are being challenged to go a whole day without turning on their taps in a brand new project hoping to provide easy access to clean water for our Pacific neighbours. Taps Off Day, a project that was launched yesterday, is being organised by leading anti-poverty organisation Oxfam and is taking place on the 22nd of March in support of families and communities in places such as Vanuatu and Papua New Guinea. Earlier today, producer Jess Smith spoke with Oxfam New Zealand's executive director, Rachel Misuria, to learn more.
Well, the aim of the Taps Off Day project is for New Zealanders all around the country to be challenged to try to go for a whole day without turning on the taps. And the point of that is to make us realise, A, how lucky we are that we can rely on water to come through the taps, and B, for New Zealanders to actually spend a day thinking about how that must be for people in the Pacific in particular who don't have access to water coming out of the taps that they can rely on to keep them safe, and to feed and look after their family.
Cool. And how does the day work?
Well, it's pretty simple, really. Basically, from midnight on, well, just 12:01, actually, on the 22nd of March, we're asking New Zealanders to turn off their taps and not turn them back on again for 24 hours. So the common sense thing is fill up water containers, fill up your kettle, fill up buckets before midnight, and try to see how it would be. Give it a go. Do it in your workplace, doing it with your friends, with your colleagues, with your neighbours. And we think it's going to be both a bit of fun and quite interesting for us to realise how much we rely on that fresh water coming out of the tap.
Yeah, for sure. And what's the situation like currently in the places like Papua New Guinea and Vanuatu regarding their access to clean water?
For many people in the Pacific, they don't have the choice. They have to deal with the reality of either not trusting the water that comes out of the tap because it's looking rusty and dirty, and they know that it's coming from polluted streams and rivers, and they're concerned for their families, or there's no tap whatsoever and they have to literally take a jerry can or a bucket and walk to the nearest river or water source. And again, they will know that whether they can trust that water, and often they don't have a choice, they have to take it anyway. I think New Zealanders are incredibly lucky. We have taken it for granted for decades that we can trust the water coming out of the taps, though we do know recently that isn't something we can always be sure of with Havelock North's experience last year. But it makes it even more clear that for those of us who are able to rely on our water, we do take it for granted. And we're asking New Zealanders to actually consider how lucky we are, and we're delighted to have Civil Defence coming in with us to support us in this, to really use this day to both appreciate clean water and really recognise the little we can do to help our colleagues and friends and family members who live in the Pacific.
Yeah, for sure. And what kind of resources will the money raised from Taps Off Day go towards?
Well, Taps Off Day, which is tapsoff.org.nz, is a great way to help in very small and very sort of practical ways. The cost to install a brand new tap is NZD$75. The cost to put in a toilet is $450. And the cost to dig a well for a ready supply of fresh water is $625 where that's feasible. So it's pretty manageable. You can see what that costs. And we're asking New Zealanders to sign up for Taps Off Day. Just go to tapsoff.org.nz, contribute $10, register for that fee, and where you can, consider donations and get some sponsorship from family and from friends and from work colleagues. But the key thing is really ensuring that you try this day, see what it'd be like, and really contribute, be part of a way of helping our Pacific neighbours get access to clean water.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's kind of the ideal outcome of the day? Like, how many people would you like to see participating?
Well, we believe that there will be New Zealanders who are very happy to respond to this challenge and will be curious to see what they can do for a day without turning on the tap. So we're looking for about 4,500 New Zealanders to participate. We'll be delighted if we can exceed that. And we're very conscious it's the first time that this has been done by Oxfam in New Zealand. So we're looking for about $45,000. So really it's going to be a great opportunity for New Zealanders to show that they care, that they want to know what it's like to go for a day without turning on the taps, and making sure that they've put the water in the buckets beforehand. We're really keen for many New Zealanders to join us on March 22nd on Taps Off Day. We are also conscious for those who may have medical reasons or perhaps heavy exertion or in some kind of sporting activity. It is important that you do have sufficient supplies. Don't put yourself at risk. We are lucky to have a really good water supply, so make sure you are well prepared and get the water into the buckets and have all the water you need so you don't have to turn the taps on for that day.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
That was Jess speaking to Rachel Masseria of Oxfam about the Taps Off initiative kicking off on the 22nd of March. We'll be back after a quick break, and stay tuned because next up we have our weekly chat with Labour leader Andrew Little.
Holiday of fear, but no.
French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Yes, we're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. I'm helping out with Jogai, our new Thursday host today. I'm Shamina, the news director here, and I will be talking now to Andrew Little for our weekly Thursday chat. How are you doing, Andrew?
Oh, very good, thanks, Shamina. Yeah, very nice.
That's great. So, big news in the Labor Party this week. Deputy Leader Annette King announced her decision to step down yesterday. Does this come as a surprise to you?
She had already made the decision that she didn't want to stand in an electorate again, and she's, you know, and we now have a new candidate for Rangitai. She indicated she was keen to go on the list. But, you know, she's been in Parliament for many, many years. She's made a huge contribution to Parliament, to New Zealand, to the Labor Party. So it didn't come as a complete surprise when she came to me on Tuesday morning and said, you know, had a good think about it, and it's time for me to step aside, both out of the deputy, but also to retire from Parliament, and I respect that decision.
So it was totally her decision? There was no internal pressure within the Labor Party for her to make the move?
It was totally her decision, and she, I think, you know, like all of us, were very pleased at Jacinda's by-election win over the weekend, and she had a good think about you know, what that could mean, and spoke to me on Tuesday morning. And part of that conversation was also to say, you know, she backs Jacinda as a replacement deputy because she thinks, you know, Jacinda has demonstrated that she's got a huge amount to contribute and to offer in that role.
Right, so on the subject of Jacinda, so you've obviously backed her quite strongly to replace King as the deputy leader. What's influenced this decision?
Well, I'm obviously known Jacinda for a long time, and she's worked very hard as a Lift MP. She's been a passionate advocate on, you know, one of the big sore points for New Zealand, and that is the way we treat children, and particularly children in poverty. So she's done a lot of work on child wellbeing, was the author of our big policy in 2014 on that, the Best Start. She stepped up when David Shearer resigned and went in to Mount Albert and fought for the campaign here. That was a very difficult by-election campaign because National wasn't there. There wasn't a natural kind of opposition, if you like. We campaigned with the Greens, but she had to work very hard to get the vote out. She demonstrated she could do that. You know, she connects well with Auckland. But actually, the big thing, thing that I think she represents, which is important, is she very much represents the generation that is missing out because of the neglect of this government on things like housing and education. And she'll bring some very strong advocacy on the policies that we're promoting to address those problems.
And so Ardern has shied away from top leadership positions in the Labor Party in the past. So what's changed now? What makes her up for it?
You know, these things, nothing happens in a straight line, and people, you know, you get involved, particularly in politics too. You spend your time sort of learning and getting to know the ropes and building your networks and just demonstrating to yourself that there's a lot that you can do and demonstrating your own leadership. And she has done that. And I think her success in the Mount Albert by-election was very much a, you know, coming together of a whole heap of talents that many of us knew she had, that she was able to demonstrate in the context of a by-election campaign and demonstrate that she kind of has what it takes and has a lot to contribute in a senior leadership role, which is why I've backed her for it.
And so Bill English has described Ardern as untested and has criticised her for being less experienced than King. How do you respond to this?
Well, Annie King has made the decision to step aside, so there was a gap there and it always had to be filled. But, I mean, we have, in a caucus of 32, we have four or five who have candidate experience. The rest of us haven't, but that's not unusual for parties that have been in a position for coming up to 9 years. What I stand by is the quality of our MPs and indeed of our candidates coming through. I was at a meeting, an Indian business meeting the other night, where a group of us, the MPs, were there, and we had, in addition to myself, we had Grant Robertson speaking, we had Jacinda, we had Michael Wood, we had Priyanka Radhakrishnan all speaking, and I have to say, I sat back and was just, you know, here was the next generation of Labor Party leadership and Labor-led government cabinet, and the Indian business people I was with all said the same thing. They said, this gives us confidence. So, we've got new talent, fresh. They might not have had cabinet experience. They don't need it to provide leadership and to govern. What they need is fresh, good ideas and the ability to communicate. We have that in spades.
Right. So you think that this new sort of generation of Labor leaders will hopefully appeal to a wider range of range of demographics going into this year's election?
Yeah, well, that's always the challenge with a big party is to get the breadth of appeal, if you like, and the depth of talent, and that's what we've certainly been working on. I'm very confident with what we've got, and I think once we get finalise all the electorate selections and then the list selection later this year, I think New Zealanders will see that we have a widespread array of talent that will be reflective and representative of New Zealand.
And so moving on to immigration, so the government announced earlier in the week record high immigration numbers. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is an issue there. I think, we're a country that's always been dependent on immigration for sure, and we've always needed to get a variety of skills from people coming from other parts of the world to provide what we need. But the sheer numbers coming in, and given that, 80% nearly settle in Auckland, it is putting huge pressure when year after year we're having that volume of new people arriving, setting up home in a city like Auckland. It is putting huge pressure on the infrastructure, on schools, on hospitals, and I think we do have to manage that better and moderate it. I don't think we can continue with the volumes that we've got.
But how do you control for that, though? How do you control where these new immigrants go?
The huge issue is you look at the work visa category, people who are coming here on work visas, that's where the big question lies, and that's where we have to manage that more carefully. There's no question in my mind that there are people being issued with work visas to do work that actually people in New Zealand could be doing, and I think we have to look closely at that.
And so kind of in relation to that, the Prime Minister justified his comments about increasing immigration numbers by saying New Zealand businesses were actually struggling to hire Kiwis because they were failing drug tests. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think it was a hideous comment to make. And you look at the figures of the people tested, people on the benefit tested, it's a very, very small proportion. There are people who struggle to get work, not because of that, but because they've been out of work for a long time. They need a bit of time to get up to speed with good work practices. There are some employers doing some great stuff on that, but I think some employers can do with a bit of help from WINS to get people who have been out of work for a long time to get just get work ready and then get into work. That's where the answer lies. But what I don't like is this. It looks like the Prime Minister is using that as some sort of excuse to do nothing, and I think the government's been totally reckless in what they've been saying and doing.
Do you think he was just referring to beneficiaries, though, or he was speaking more widely in terms of all job seekers?
He was talking about young people failing tests as a justification for more immigration. So I think it was pretty clear what he was pointing to. I think it was pretty irresponsible of the Prime Minister to do that.
So it's clear that what do you mean he was clear? What was he pointing to? That it was just young people in general?
I think he was talking about young people, and he said it was justifying the level of immigration, saying employers can't employ local people. And yet we know that there are people out of work, young people in particular, that number is growing, and they're not being given a chance. That is wrong. We've got to do better.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for speaking with us this week. Andrew, we'll talk to you again next week. Andrew? Okay, I think he's gone. Thanks, Andrew. We will be back again with Andrew Little, the leader of the Labour Party, next week for our weekly chat. Next up is the song Open Up, featuring John Lydon by Left Field. That...
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
You are tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. We just had Andrew Little on for our weekly chat. Thanks for that, Andrew. Next, we have an investigation into the role of state-funded television in local communities and what needs to happen to TVNZ in order for it to fit the current media climate. BFM reporter Joel Thomas spoke to a series of media critics and commentators to learn more.
The role of traditional terrestrial television has fallen into uncertainty as television moves towards digital and online content, and the model of state-owned and funded television has come under question. Critics, including politicians and academics, say the current system doesn't work the way it should and are calling for changes to be made. One bold example from last month was the proposal by Opportunities Party leader Gareth Morgan to sell off TVNZ. They've claimed that the station's profits are declining, so the station should be sold for the money to be spent on public interest journalism. I spoke to the Opportunities Party's Jeff Simmons, who suggested the money NZ On Air offers is already enough to make socially responsible television dramas.
So what we're suggesting is let's sell the channel while we can, or both the channels, TV1 and 2, and get whatever money we can get for them while they still have value. You know, because in 10, 15 years' time, they could be worth nothing. And reinvest that in public interest journalism, regardless of what channel that is coming down.
Sure. So you've talked about public interest journalism and putting the money towards there. But do you think the government has a responsibility to provide money towards socially responsible original drama and content?
Well, yes, and that's what the government does through NZ On Air, and what we're suggesting is a similar approach could be taken to public interest journalism. NZ On Air has been dabbling in this area with the likes of, well, obviously it's been funding Radio New Zealand for quite some time, but it's a separate pot. But it's been dabbling in this area with the funding of The Nation and Q&A in recent years, and we think that is only likely to continue and increase over time. You know, and in particular, we need to be funding public interest journalism that reaches out to young people, stuff that engages young people in our democracy, because one of the biggest issues we face as a country is the declining rate of voting amongst young people. I think we've already got a funding pot for original TV dramas and all that sort of stuff, so you know, that sort of stuff is already catered for. The big gap in the current model of New Zealand On Air, the thing that they haven't been asked to take care of is public interest journalism, and that's why we're solely focused on that.
The Opportunities Party leader, Gareth Morgan, has stated that TVNZ journalists have no integrity because of the for-profit way the station is run. He says he doesn't want TVNZ to be state-owned and that there are plenty of television channels already. Television critics have shown their support for this policy, questioning the quality of content provided by TVNZ and NZ On Air. They've suggested that because of the current standard of television and the current models of content creation, the money should be spent elsewhere. I asked spin-off editor and television critic Duncan Grieve whether he thinks the country needs more state-funded television.
No. I mean, I think it's a nice to have, but we've been providing really low-quality, well, not low-quality, but to me, uninspired drama to New Zealand for quite a while now. We've spent, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars doing it. I don't think the country's been particularly enriched for it. You know, I think it'll be really nice to have it, and if there's a way of doing it that can get reliably and better outcomes, then I'd love to see that. But, you know, I think in terms of the list of things that we'd really like to have that we currently don't, I would say more public interest digital journalism is of much higher value and greater need than another season of Filthy Rich or similar.
Some theorists disagree with the solution of selling TVNZ. They believe state-funded and owned television is instrumental in creating a sense of national community, as well as supporting smaller, less represented communities and subcultures. I talked to Dr. Misha Kavka about this. She suggests a disconnect between the existing models of content creation and distribution and what people actually want.
I don't think the solution is to sell off TVNZ. I mean, for two reasons. One is because whoever buys it will just do more of the same model, but also because TVNZ, for all intents and purposes, has already been sold off.
So do you think maybe if there was some sort of internal structural change to the way that TVNZ works, that would be more of a solution than to sell it off?
Yeah, I can kind of make a few constructive points about that. So what TVNZ and then TV3 started to do was to make content available, like on-demand content available, right? So you can watch those on demand, and it used to be just in case you missed the show, you could catch up on demand, but then they actually started showing programs on demand only, right? So TVNZ in particular had shows, like syndicated shows that they had paid for to be able to broadcast, which they didn't actually program into the TV set schedule, but rather just put on demand. Now that is absolutely moving in the right direction. The question is how to get more local content into that online experience so that people want to go and access it. Right? That's the question. And that probably requires slightly different funding models than what we're currently using. And I would say that it probably means picking up more on the local talent that we see in other online places, like in web series and things like that. There are kind of interesting things going on that are totally self-funded, but I don't think that the TV production industry is picking up on that. They're not really working to raise up local talent and fund bigger productions that they can then distribute online as New Zealand shows.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so that would be, you know, that would be my sense of how the model has to change.
State-funded television and state-owned channels can play an important role in the creation and preservation of national communities, but according to critics and theorists, New Zealand's current for-profit model of television production leaves much to be desired in terms of supporting communities and telling strong local stories. One way to improve this, according to Dr. Misha Kavka, is to nurture and support local talent. Though there is a desire for more funding in areas of public interest journalism, we are left asking if selling TVNZ is the best way to get money for this instead of reforming the state-owned network. Joel Thomas, 95 BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That was Joel's report on TVNZ.
That was The Wire.
We now have Lucy Z and Maha El-Badrawi in the studio with us. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey, Jogai.
So they are the creators of TVNZ's original three-part animated miniseries, So This Happened, which was released last week. So each episode sort of outlines an individual experience, and they all kind of have a comedic element throughout them as well. But for the most part, the series deals with quite poignant issues. So for those who don't know, can you guys explain a little bit what it's about?
Sure. So it's short animated videos, and it's women telling stories of times that they experience harassment, whether it's sexual harassment or racism, in their own words and set to animation. And it's the kind of stories that you just hear all the time, and every woman I know has at least 10 of them, so we thought we'd just put it out there.
Mm.
Lucy?
Yeah, the same. Ditto.
Sums it up, isn't
Ditto.
It?
Ditto. But yeah, I think because everyone has a story. At least one story, and you tell your friends, like you'd mostly tell your guy friends, and they don't believe you because they're insane, right?
Yeah,
I'm sure you have a story.
Right on. Yeah,
I'm sure every woman in this room,
mm-hmm. yeah,
has a story, and you could repeat them to like your parents, your dad, your brother, your guy friends, and most of them don't believe us.
Mm.
But why would I make this shit up?
And like you said, it kind of does shed light on these experiences of women regarding like very casual sexual harassment and racism. And it's really cool that you've explored those nuances that very much form the fabric of our everyday lives. The second episode is your story, Maha.
Yes.
And it details the reality of your experience as a young Iraqi woman living in a post 9/11 world. So can you talk about that a bit?
Yep. So it happens. This kind of thing happens fairly frequently. But so basically, I was at a bar with my workmates, and there was this guy, and he asked me where I was from, which is a question that I get asked almost daily. And I said I'm from Iraq, and then he says, "Oh, are you a terrorist?" And I'm sure that this guy thought he was being hilarious and original. But and I just, you know, sometimes I just don't feel like dealing with these sorts of things, so I just turned away and I said no. And my workmates kind of, they were like, why did you just let that pass? Like, why didn't you call him up on his bullshit? And I just explained to them that this, I just wanted to explain to them the thought process behind how you deal with these types of microaggressions, because it's not just the moment, it's the history behind this moment that kind of informs how you react. And I wasn't really sure how to explain to them that when you're faced with this kind of accusation, you tend to go into this mode where you're just like, I don't want to look like I'm crazy because this guy already thinks I'm crazy because of all the representation of, you know, Middle Eastern people in the media. And if I come off as aggressive, it's just going to kind of be two wrongs.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, no, I definitely feel that. Lucy, yeah. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, it's like when people say, like, oh, where are you from? Everyone, like, who are people of colour?
I feel that version, so hard.
Yeah, like, where are you really from?
Where are you from? And, like, you just you answer it, and, like, with all the experiences of times that someone has asked you, you have your version of an answer. So you just go, oh, I'm from New Zealand. My parents are from China. I'm from New Zealand. And they go, oh, okay. Or, you know, like,
they demand this entire speech about your ancestry.
You but then also, you kind of have to remember, well, a lot of these people are curious and they do want to know. And I'm not ashamed of my ethnicity. So I have been trying to be more patient and say to people, explain to them and then bore them to death. And then the whole conversation will end.
And sometimes also you just don't feel like telling your whole life story to a stranger.
No,
but
you just did now.
Yeah, I know. To a lot of strangers.
Yeah, right on. And I particularly like the progression of Katerina's story, which I think is the third episode, and what she goes through. It's quite a traumatic ordeal on public transport, and she shows, I think, the most active action against it by the end. Justice is kind of served. But there is a moment in between, though, where she asks the driver to do something about the situation and he doesn't really make much of it.
Mm-hmm.
Does this dismissive attitude towards casual harassment play a large part in women's reluctance to speak about these things?
Oh, absolutely. Like the whole reason why I wanted to do this was because I think the sooner we talk about this shit happening, the sooner that, like, guys around us can recognize that, yeah, you kind of do need to help and you kind of do and should say something. And the more we talk about it, maybe the sooner, you know, the stuff will end. Like, you should be calling out your friends. Like, if you're a dude and you have another dude friend who's gross and creepy, call him out. What's the worst that can happen? He'll stop being your friend and, yay, you don't have a creepy friend anymore. Like, oh no, like, I don't know.
A lot of this behavior is just excused as, you know, boys being boys, and it's just tolerated. And that's a big part of the problem, is because it's just something that you're expected to deal with as a woman. And it's not okay. It's just not okay. And that's what we're trying to say.
And isn't it crazy that a lot of people just won't take your lived experience as, like, enough and they have to see it on television or in pop culture in order to believe it as a legitimate thing.
Yeah. Can you imagine if a woman behaved this way towards men? Like, they'd be called crazy.
Totally.
Yes, I was going to ask more about how the project sort of came about. Where'd you get the idea?
Oh, yeah, so because I know people are super, we both work at TVNZ.
Shout outs.
But so we've worked there for like 3 years now, and we see the stuff that comes through and what is put on TV, and we get it. Like, we're, late 20s, and so we totally get, like, we do Netflix and all that stuff. We're not like, just because I work somewhere doesn't mean I, like, you don't listen to BFM 24/7. You have to go to sleep, right?
Her boss is
during when you sleep and everything. So
I'm trying to keep my gigs.
So. Yeah, okay, sorry. So, like, we totally see the stuff that comes through, and I think we got given an opportunity where we could do something, and I was like, we were thinking, do something that will mean something that we're actually going to be proud of.
Yeah.
Because, like, you make stuff most of your life and you're like, oh, whatever, I just need the paycheck to end. But
yeah,
this is one of those projects where we're genuinely so proud of us, like,
it's really invested in it. And it's something that I'll definitely remember.
Yeah. So
we work on so many things that we just never even see.
No. So yeah, TVNZ kind of gave a bunch of people an opportunity to create content. And Maha had this idea to do it, and she brought me on board to help with
it. And it all started when we were just standing in the kitchen. It was a Friday afternoon, and we were having some work drinks, and we somehow, it was a group of young women, all about our age, same age as us, and we somehow got onto the topic of times when we experience sexual harassment, but it was just sort of not dealt with. And Minnie, who is a publicist at TVNZ, she shared her story, which is the one that you see in the first episode, and it just, and then another woman shared her story, and then I shared my story, and then it just went around and around in a circle, and all of a sudden I had this moment where I was just like, everyone I know has 10 of these stories. What if we were to tell them and share them in a way, in that same way where you're just sort of with your friends and you share it like when you're comfortable, and there's this sort of element of humor to it.
Yeah.
It makes it more palatable. I ran to Amy Mills, our creative director, and I pitched it to her, and she's like, great. And then she shared her story with me, and I was like, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Everyone's got these.
Mm. And it was really important for me to get these women to tell their stories, but in the most comfortable environment as possible. So it was literally a group of girls. We kicked this dude out for you can't be here.
Like, you can't be
in
here,
a locked little room, and sat around on a couch and just mic'd them up and just let them say what they wanted. And we edited it down, obviously, for time, because we wanted it to be quite short, because I feel like anything longer than 2.5 minutes is too long.
Mm.
Anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Movies,
absolutely.
Videos, sex, everything. So 2.5 minutes is ideal. And so also I was adamant that I wanted to foster new talent. So the people who animated aren't from TVNZ.
Mm.
They're young students and graduated students who animate.
Oh, cool.
And they're not dudes. They're not boys.
Yeah, we just gave them a brief, which is basically 2D animation. We need this much for the intro, this much for the outro, and then for the rest of it, they just were given freedom to express the story, represent the story however they saw fit. And that's why you got these three very distinct styles, which I love.
Loved. Were you also working on the animation, Lucy? I feel like I saw fragments of it on social media, just following you on Instagram.
So I was sharing it, because every time I got something new and I would take a photo. But one of the animators is my little sister. One of the stories is my best friend, and it's animated by my little sister. So for me, that's my favorite, because I'm quite connected to it. But yeah, we're wanting to get stories from people all over the country, people we don't know, and
we want to get different perspectives, both from the stories and from the animators themselves.
So leading off that, what is kind of next for you guys? Do you have any other creative projects on store, or are you just looking to expand this one?
We're going to expand this. We've got a few more episodes to do. We're in the process, if anyone's listening and they our animators, hit us up.
Yeah.
Lucille.ze@tvnz.co.nz, or just tweet me, whatever. But we need more animators, and it's really hard to find animators in this country.
Tweet Lucy. I'm a lot harder to find. she's better at this than I am. I also want to give can I do an actual shout out?
Go for
a shout out to Randa, who provided us with our In and Out music for the series, who is amazing. One of my favorite musicians, and I've worked with him a lot, and I produced Friday Night Bites, and we use his music quite a lot on Friday Night Bites, and he's just the best. You should listen to his music.
Randa is the best. What's Randa's Bandcamp or Spotify?
It's
Lars Rand.
Just get Lars Rand
shout-outs
now.
Shout-outs to my mom.
My husband.
Okay, well, it's really cool that you've extracted these experiences and turned them into something so creative and productive, and animation and storytelling. It's fantastic. It's engaging.
Thanks.
Thank you, Lucy and Maha, for coming in again. You can catch So This Happened on TVNZ On Demand or on their YouTube channel.
Thanks, Jogai.
Thanks, Jogai.
It's all good.
That was The Wire.
That is the end of our show for another week. Thanks to those who spoke with us today. Will Matthews, Rachel Lemasuria, Andrew Little, Duncan Grieve, Jeff Simmons, Dr. Misha Kapka, Zoe Hawke, Lucy Z, and Maha Albadrawi. A big thanks to my producer, Jess, and to our news director, Shemena Smith, for helping me out today. And of course, a big thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into The Wire this week. We'll be back again, same time next Thursday. Sigrid is up next with the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.